Now, Andy, did you hear about this one? Tell me, are you locked in the pond? Andy, are you goofing on Elvis? Do you believe it? Are we losing touch? If you believe they put a man on the moon, man on the moon.
REM's Man on the Moon on the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Craig Cohen. That song is a tribute of sorts to the late Andy Kaufman. Man on the Moon is also the name of an upcoming biopic about the enigmatic performer. In this hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we talk with the co-executive producer of the film, Bob Zmuda. We welcome your questions and comments for our guest at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 1-800-222-9455. WILL. Bob Zmuda is the Emmy and Ace Award-winning creator of HBO's Comic Relief telecasts, which brought together Whoopi Goldberg, Billy Crystal, Robin Williams, and the top stand-up comedians of the day to raise money for the homeless. In the mid to late 70s and early 80s, Zmuda wrote and produced for his friend Andy Kaufman. His new book is Andy Kaufman Revealed, published by Little Brown & Company. The novel chronicles his friendship and unique working relationship with Kaufman. Bob, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Now, just to get started, right off the bat, how did you get your start in comedy?
Well, I started in Chicago with a lot of guerrilla theater back in the 60s, and then eventually moved to New York City and was part of a comedy team over 20 years ago back at the Improvisation when it was the first and only comedy club in America. So I've been kicking around doing this for a long time.
Did those early years in New York have any impact on you later in life and how it was particularly struggling as a comic when there was just one comedy club?
Well, it was amazing because the Improvisation, which was the granddaddy of all the comedy clubs, when I walked into that place, Elaine Boozler was the singing waitress. Jay Leno was a performer there. He had no money. He had a broken-down motorcycle. He always had grease on him, always trying to put the chain back on the cycle. You had Larry David there. You had Richard Lewis. You had Richard Belzer. So it was really quite amazing that all of these people came out of this little group. And we were just kids. We were like 19, 20 years old.
And among them was Andy Kaufman. When did you first see him perform?
I walked in that club, and Andy... And I just paid my 2-drink minimum, and I went in. Andy did a very unique thing. He would come in, before he went on stage, he would hang out by the bar area at the Improv for about 2 hours beforehand, totally fooling the audience members coming into the establishment that he was from out of town, that he was a foreigner. That's when he was doing Foreign Man, or the character that then became Latka on Taxi. Thank you very much, that character. And he would be begging Bud Freeman, the owner of the club, to put him on stage. So when I walked in there, this audience believed that this guy was real. And so finally at the end of the show, Bud Freeman says, look, folks, don't tell your friends to come in here and do this. I never do this, but this man's been bothering all night, and I'm going to put him on stage. His name's Andy. And then, of course, he went on stage, and he was awful. That was the idea of the act. This Foreign Man character was a terrible impressionist. He said, I'd like to do my impression of Archie Bunker. You meathead, get out of me chair. You dingbat, go into the kitchen and make me the food. And it was so bad. You'd sit there in the audience and you were so embarrassed for this guy. And he worked the audience, and then he did a unique thing. Then he did a drop-dead Elvis. Then after Elvis, he went back to thank you very much. So you believe that this guy was just this foreign guy that just had this drop-dead Elvis. Well, I was so fascinated by this, and he totally killed. And you realize, so I followed him out to his car, and he saw me standing there. And he came up to me and said, I have bad back, and I think this guy's for real. Can you help me with my props? And for the next 15, 20 minutes, I loaded all of his props. I mean, he had a 16-millimeter projector and a screen and two sets of congas and puppets and a record player and all that. And after 15 minutes, my back was hurting me. And I put all the stuff in his car, and he looks at me and he goes, thank you very much, sucker. And then he drove off. I loved him.
And so sucker was the first word you heard from him
in the real word,
natural voice.
Exactly. And then I realized I had been had and that he had been performing just for me, so I wasn't mad or anything. I just loved it. And then, of course, I started working at the Improv, and I was part of a comedy team there of Albrecht and Zmuda. And him and I just hit it off, and we started exchanging stories about a lot of the guerrilla things, of a lot of the psychodrama kind of theater that I did in Chicago, and he was fascinated by it, and we just both looked at entertainment and the world of comedy through the same eyes.
You mentioned Elvis, and his Elvis impersonation was extremely good, down to that quivering lip and everything. Elvis was extremely important to Andy. His one encounter with the King has sort of become legend. Maybe you could tell folks
yes,
what
in
that was all about.
Yes, first of all, people have to realize Andy Kaufman was the first Elvis impersonator. Nobody was doing Elvis around then. That came years later where everybody jumped on the bandwagon and started doing Elvis Presley impressions. Andy Kaufman was the first one. This is like around 1967, 68. The Beatles are big. Nobody cares about Elvis. Elvis is gone. Nobody's interested at all. Elvis then had a return date in Vegas in 1969. Andy Kaufman was not famous. He had no money. He hitchhiked all the way from the East Coast to Las Vegas to meet his idol. Andy had no money to buy a ticket to see the show, but what he did is he snuck into the bowels of the Hilton Hotel in the kitchen area, knowing that Elvis would come down this route. He said it to him. Andy said it was kind of like he was like Sirhan Sirhan. He was hiding in a cupboard. And he had written in longhand, he had about 200 pages of some book he had written about Elvis that he wanted to show Elvis. Well, of course, Elvis came down, was on the way to the stage with the West brothers, Red West and his brother, who were Elvis's bodyguards. And Andy kind of jumped out of the shadows there. And the West brothers thought, oh, what's this? And they were just about ready to, go for their guns or something. When Elvis said, no, it's okay, you could see it was a harmful kid, was no harm done for Elvis. And he finally... And he looked at Elvis, and he said, I wrote this book about you. And he said, and someday I'm going to be famous too. And Elvis looked at him, patted him on the shoulder, and he says, that's very good. You do that. And he left. And Andy Kaufman had the blessing of the King. And it was soon after that he went to New York City and established himself as one of the hottest acts in the town.
So the two of you are in New York, and you're meeting up before the shows and swapping stories and talking about your jobs and your lives. And in particular, Andy, I guess, was most interested in your stories about somebody that you identify in your book as Mr. X. Now,
yes.
Tell us as much as you can over broadcast airwaves about this man.
You've read about Mr. X, yeah.
Yes.
Boy, I don't know if I can. Mr. X was a very strange guy. He was a very famous screenwriter. I can't give his name. He's still alive. And for legal reasons, I can't do that. But what he did, this guy hired me. And my job was, I had three tape recorders on me. I would follow this guy around. My job, I had a suitcase. Every morning, we'd fill up a suitcase with between $20,000 and $30,000 cold cash. Then I went around the streets of New York with this guy. I had three tape recorders. One tape recorder would be playing music that he liked, Sousa or the Supremes. Another tape recorder would be playing back what we recorded the day before, 24 hours before, okay? And then another tape recorder would be playing back what we're recording right now. And what Mr. X did then is that he would get in fights with people, where people wanted to kill us. I mean, that's why I had the cash. I had to, pay people off not to beat us up, not to kill us. And he recorded all this material. And what he did then, we would then go back to his office, and he had three secretaries take this material off of the tapes, type it up, and it would go into many major motion pictures. Nobody could write street dialogue like this guy did because he didn't write it. He recorded it. And it was amazing stuff, and he became known as one of the big Hollywood screenwriting doctors for street pictures because he had the ear, which was, in fact, me carrying the stuff and almost getting killed. So Andy was fascinated by this. He thought that was so neat, that what a psychodrama to go out there and play with people's heads like that. And that's exactly what Andy did in his act. He went out and played with the audience. And as you know, many times, it wasn't about getting laughter or applause. He might want to get the audience mad at him, and did. Many people hated Andy Kaufman. And he went out there, and he just wanted real reactions from people. He'd go out, and he'd read The Great Gatsby at times and clear the room. We'd be out on college campuses, and he'd bring The Great Gatsby out. I'd say, Andy, please don't read that. And people would be asking for their money back. He'd just be laughing his head off.
For Andy and for Mr. X, in both cases, were they primarily interested in how people reacted in unusual situations or more in uncomfortable situations?
Probably both, but I think it was uncomfortable. Andy loved to get an audience uncomfortable. He just, and that's why there's so many of these performers like Robin Williams and Jim Carrey and David Letterman and Bobcat Goldthwait and the late Sam Kennison and the list goes, Michael Richards, the list goes on. And these guys in comedy are just so fascinated by Kaufman because he was a daredevil. Robin Williams called him the kamikaze of comedy, that nobody went out there and risked failing. You know, and not see. Andy changed the rules of engagement with in show business. In other words, before Andy was like a performer wants to be loved or certainly liked by the audience. Andy said, "Forget that. You don't need to be loved or liked by these people. That's not your job. You're an artist. You go out there and you do what you have to do." So he threw that out, and then in comedy, he really broke the rules. He said, "You don't have to be funny. You just have to be interesting." So it was such an unusual, he just broke the rules. That's why Universal Studios is making a $70 million movie about him. That's why Milos Forman, two-time Academy winning director for Amadeus, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He's so fascinated by Kaufman, and so is Jim Carrey.
Yeah, and I've seen actually a picture of Jim in full makeup as Andy, and it's frankly, it's spooky.
It was spooky. Jim did great research on this film. It's amazing because Milos Forman did not want anyone to play this role unless they made an audition tape, and everybody wanted to play Andy. Tom Hanks wanted to play him, Sean Penn, Nicolas Cage, Ed Norton, of course, Jim Carrey, Hank Azaria. The list went on because they were so fascinated by this character. And Milos said, look, whoever's going to play this role has to make an audition tape. Well, you don't ask some of these guys to make an audition tape. And Milos's thinking was this. It's not like you're doing Abe Lincoln. Who knows how Abe Lincoln talked, right? Because of the replays of At Nick at Night of Taxi and because of appearances of Saturday Night Live reruns, people would know if this performer is doing a good Kaufman or not. So Jim Carrey makes this audition tape, and he calls me up. I did not know Jim. I'm going, oh, $20 million star calling me up. He said, Bob, come on to my house. I made the audition tape. Before I show it to Milos, excuse me, I want you to see it. And I'm driving there, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. First of all, in my head, I'm thinking, there's no way is he going to pull this off. And nobody, how dare anyone think they're going to play my best friend? It ain't going to happen. So I'm thinking of lines driving there like, ooh, that's interesting, Jim. Wow, you know, where I'm not committed. And I go into his house. He puts this tape in, and I broke down like a little baby. I just started crying. It was unbelievable. If somebody had given me this tape and said it wasn't Jim Carrey, that, oh, we found this old tape of Andy Kaufman for performing, and if I would have saw it, I'd say, well, yeah, that's Andy.
Wow.
Yeah, he's and like, you know, Danny DeVito, of course, went on David Letterman a couple months ago and said that Jim Carrey will be nominated and win an Academy Award for playing Andy Kaufman.
And you're not just saying this because you're co-executive producer of the film.
No, not at all. Listen, because I'll tell you why. I have no points on this film, right? If I wanted to, listen, especially now with my book out there, right, it would be very easy for me to start attacking the film and say, forget the movie.
Yeah.
You want to read the real Andy? I'll read my book. No, not at all. I think Andy would be proud, and I think, you know, the buzz already in Hollywood is that he's done an incredible job.
Well, that's good because there are so many instances where there will be pictures that are biographies of an individual, and then those who are close to that person aren't happy with the results,
right.
Or it will be vastly different from who the person was in life, and it's good to know that it's actually going to be true to the spirit of the individual.
Absolutely, and the fact of the matter is that we were there, I was there every day for 87 days while the shooting of this movie went on. So was George Shapiro, who was Andy Kaufman's manager, who was played by Danny DeVito. So was Lynn Margulies, the love of Andy's life, who was played by Courtney Love. All three of us were on that set every day, and believe me, we had only one thing in mind, that they captured the spirit and the magic of Andy, and they did.
That's Bob Zemuda. He's creator of HBO's Comic Relief Specials and co-executive producer of Man on the Moon. He was a good friend and collaborator of Andy Kaufman's, and he's written a new book, Andy Kaufman Revealed, published by Little Brown & Company. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455, 333-WILL or 1-800-222-WILL. You know, I have to admit, I am fascinated by Mr. X, not just because I don't know the man's name, but because I really could get a sense of what sheer, well, hell you must have gone through.
Well, like I said, you know, I quit after 3 weeks. I thought I was going to get killed by people. People were pulling guns and knives. I mean, it was fascinating. And I was getting like $3,000 a week, you know, off the books, cold cash. And I had no money at the time. I still had to quit. He said, I'm going to die.
And he would just go into public and pick fights with people?
Unbelievable. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just pick fights. And it was just, you know, in one case, and I would tell the story about the glazed donut. He went, we stopped at a bakery. Mm-hmm. And he went in. It was about 2 in the afternoon. Little ladies were standing in line. And he went in and he says, I want a glazed donut. And the woman behind the counter, her name was something like Flo. She said, sir, you'll have to take a ticket like everyone else. He shuts up. He doesn't say a word. He stands in line. And I'm going, oh, boy, what does he have up his sleeve? Finally, it's his turn. The woman says, now, you wanted a glazed donut. Is that correct? No, I have changed my mind. I want that and this. And he starts pointing to everything. Then she says, sir, I'm not here to play games. And he says, Muda, open up the case. Well, I open up the case with about $20,000 in it. The manager comes out, and he starts buying everything in the bakery. Not only in the front of the store, he goes in the back of the bakery, whatever they got in the fridge, in the freezer, whatever they're baking now, he is going to go through every pat of butter, every cup of sugar and flour. Then he starts offering money to the bakers that they, you know, that it's hot in there, that if they take off their clothes, they could leave their shorts on. But if they take off their clothes, he'll give them $500, $1,000 each. And they start doing that. And then, of course, the women who work there, the servers, he starts in on them. He says, I'll give you $1,000. You can leave your girdle and bra on. Just take that off. And of course, they do it because he's paying them thousands of dollars, except for Flo, that woman that made him wait in line. He starts in on her. She will not take anything off. He says, how much does your husband, what does your husband do for a living? He's a truck driver. How much does he make a year? $17,000. I will pay you $17,000. Take off your skirt. Take off your blouse. You got your bra and girdle on. And all the other employees there are telling her to do it, to take this money. She won't do it. And I'll never forget walking out of the place. The last thing, he goes back in the limo. I turn around. There is not anything left in the place. These people are standing around in their underwear, counting their money. Flo is crying. You know, I mean, she's been destroyed. She has not removed any of her clothing. And when I look back, the last thing I see in that bakery window was one glazed donut.
I can see why Andy Kaufman had an affection for this guy.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, he said this was Andy Kaufman's role model.
Now, did the two of you ever experiment in the same way as Mr. X, literally out in public?
Well, of course. That's, you know, that's what's so amazing is that probably only 2% of what Andy Kaufman did was recorded on tape. The rest was on street corners, you know, in restaurants, on planes. And he, from the moment he stepped out of bed in the morning till he went to sleep, he was on and pulling pranks and hoaxes on people continually. And that's what he's known for. That's what Andy Kaufman is known for. He's not a stand-up comedian. He's a guy who puts on practical jokes and elaborate hoaxes. So we had great fun with that.
Yeah, and actually, that brings up an interesting point, which is that since he wasn't really a stand-up comic, and yet the one place that he was able to perform routinely would be in those comedy clubs.
Well, that's why he got mislabeled early on. I don't look at Andy used to call when he was he hated the term that anybody called him a comedian. He says, I'm not a comedian. I'm a song and dance man. That's what he would say. I, of course, believe that he was really a behavioral scientist because he just liked messing with people's heads. He wanted real reactions from audiences. If that might even be hate. In some cases, it might be boredom, like when he would read The Great Gatsby and Empty Out of Place. It was so different and so unique and so original. And like I said, that's the reason they've made this movie about him.
Was he ever concerned, or were you ever concerned, about whether or not it's sort of breaking a contract between the artist and the performer, and that people, at least as time would go on, certainly not initially in the comedy clubs when they maybe wouldn't charge very much, but you know, would be putting down money to see comedians tell jokes? And here's somebody that comes along and changes that all around.
Well, you know, it was so hard for him originally because what he did was so different. Just, you know, like guys like Jay Leno would pull their hair out because Jay came out of the same club, The Improv, and Jay was a real wordsmith, you know. that just, you know, nothing, you know, change a little beat here and you're either going to get the joke or not. And here you had this other guy, Andy Kaufman, who would come on stage, eat a bowl of potatoes, and go to sleep in a sleeping bag for 20 minutes, and the audience would be rolling on the floor. It was just so different. And so, you know, he's probably considered, Andy probably was probably the first performance artist. This is a term that's out there now. It didn't exist at the time when Andy was back then starting out. And if you had to put this in perspective, like musically, you'd probably say the Stooge, yes.
Yeah. What were you trying to get out of that routine when you guys put that together?
Well, of course, it was, and many times he would do this when he would play this alter ego by the name called Tony Clifton, which was this lounge act. And he would come out as if he was a bad Vegas lounge singer. And that was Tony Clifton. He would do this with sunglasses, a mustache, a toupee, a bad jacket. Excuse me. And I would be a plant in the audience. And he would come and he would come up and he would abuse me and end up pouring my glass of Chianti over my head. And this would get people so furious. And I would, of course, run out of the place crying. You know, I'd run out of the front door, and he, of course, would run out of the back door. He'd keep his dad's car engine running in back, and we'd jump and we'd pull away, and we laughed. You know, it wasn't like, what was he trying to accomplish? Andy Kaufman was there to entertain one person and one person only, himself. Himself. He was not there to entertain the audience. He reversed the roles. As a matter of fact, and many times, he became the audience, and the audience became the performer. That's why he's so unique.
I keep getting the image in my mind of, you know, as you go out the front and he goes out the back and meet up in the car. It's almost a Robert Redford and Paul Newman in The Sting kind of.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. It felt like that, let me tell you.
I want to make sure that we get back to Tony Clifton in particular, Tony Clifton's appearance on the set of Taxi. At some point in the hour, we can't miss that. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the early Saturday Night Lives. What were some of the routines that Andy did, and what was so unusual, and what kind of audience reaction?
Well, of course, when Andy started, and he did start on Saturday Night Live, he was on the he was a semi regular on Saturday Night Live, especially when they started off. Andy Kaufman is on the first Saturday Night Live with George Carlin when that show started. And at that point, he was doing things such as Mighty Mouse, as people remember, with the record player that he'd lip-sync to the Mighty Mouse, or he'd do the Cow Goes Moo. And he was all this childlike stuff. Now, this is what's very weird. Andy, when Andy was about 11 years old, he, to make extra money, he put up signs in supermarkets to have, he called himself Uncle Andy to perform at your child's birthday. You know, you pay him like $15 on Uncle Andy, and he wouldn't allow any adults in the room. And he would just be with a 7 or 8 year old, and he'd do puppets, you know, and he'd do magic tricks and sing alongs and all this real childlike stuff. Well, when he's 19 years old, he goes to Graham Junior College in Boston. It no longer exists. And a girl on campus who he's attracted to asks him if he could be in the talent show that night. And he says, "Well, I don't know what I would do." He said, "Wait a second, there's an act I used to do for kids when I was 11 years old." She said, "Well, do that." So here, what the magic and what made Andy hit was the juxtaposition of taking that childlike material and performing it for adults in a nightclub atmosphere. And that was lightning in the bottle. And he saw just the reaction was so great that, of course, he got out of school. He went to New York City into the improvisation, and then he used that originally. So originally he started with this childlike material, and then, of course, once he ran out of that is when then he brought me in to be his writer, and then we came up with a whole bunch of new stuff.
And actually, I have to say, maybe my favorite Kaufman-esque moment has to be his performance at Carnegie Hall, or more specifically, afterwards.
Carnegie Hall was amazing. What he did there, and he first of all, he started the show by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, it's every performer's dream to play Carnegie Hall. It certainly was mine. And ever since I was a little boy, I told my grandma that someday I'm going to play Carnegie Hall. I'm going to give her the best seat in the house." So he brings his grandma out. She was living in Hollywood, Florida, a Jewish retirement area. And he flew her out to New York and brought her on stage and told the story. And he said to her, he said, "Now, Grandma, be honest. Did you ever think I'd really play Carnegie Hall?" And she says, "No, Andy, I really didn't." I really didn't think you'd amount to anything. You know, mm-hmm. And she was surprised. What did I tell you? You play clarinet. What else did I tell you? She said, I don't know. What else did I tell you? That I have the best seat in the house. That's right. And ladies and gentlemen, can we bring my grandma's sofa out? He flew the sofa out from Florida, and she sat on it for 3 hours. She sat stage left. We had a little table for her with some tea, and occasionally we had somebody come out and ask her if she had to go to the bathroom or anything. She sat there very nice. Now, Andy does a great show for 3 hours. At the end of that show, he says to the audience, I'd like to thank my guests. Well, he didn't really have any guests. And just as he says, as if he's making this up in his head, he said, I'd like to thank the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And just then, the back doors of Carnegie Hall open up, and all 350 members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, in full robes and regalia, are walking down the aisle, Edie, Edie, singing. And then people go, what? He said, I'd like to thank the New York City Rockettes. And just then, from either side of the proscenium stage, Rockettes, 35 members, and they come out, and they're kicking their legs, and people going, this is wild. And he says, I'd like to thank, it was around Christmas time, I'd like to thank Santa Claus. And just then, Santa Claus comes on stage, and it starts snowing on stage, and the Mormon Navajo Choir is doing this, and the Rockettes are kicking their legs. And Andy, at that point, says, I'd like to thank my grandma, played by, and just then, this little old lady gets up off this couch. She walks to the footlights of Carnegie Hall stage. He says, I'd like to thank my grandma, played by Robin Williams. And Robin rips the face off, throws it into the crowd. Pandemonium broke loose. People had to be settled down. I'm telling you, people that were there will say it is the greatest show they ever saw in their life. At the end, he calms them down. He says, wait a second. He says, ladies and gentlemen, that is the first act of my show. For the second act, will you please go outside now? We have 35 school buses that are going to take you for milk and cookies. Well, everybody thinks he's joking. Until they went outside, and on Fifth Avenue, we had 35 buses that took the entire audience out to another undisclosed location for milk and cookies, where we had rent, and I had rented every small little kindergarten chair and table I could find in the New York area. And we had these people sit at these little chairs and tables, and they had their milk and cookies. Now, this went on until about 1 a.m., and finally I said to Andy, Andy, we got to pull the plug on this because I know we're going to get into serious overtime with the buses. And it's 1 a.m. and nobody's leaving. So I said, you're going to lose $10,000 unless you get these people on the buses back to Carnegie Hall. He says, well, what should I tell them? I said, tell them this. Tell them that Act 3 is going to take place. They should go home now and get some sleep. Act 3 is going to take place at the Staten Island Ferry at 9 a.m. And we forgot about it. Well, now I haven't slept in days. And the next morning at 8:30, my phone starts ringing. I know it's Kaufman. I don't answer it. There's a knock on the door. Andy says, Bob, I know you're in there. Bob, please listen. Don't you think we should go down to Staten Island? And I'm like, Andy, nobody's going to show up. But then, of course, I'm thinking, what if one press person shows up? We jump in a cab. We go down to the Staten Island Ferry. There are 350 people from the night before standing there like little kids with the biggest smiles. Andy proceeds to buy each one of them a round-trip ticket on the Staten Island Ferry, an ice cream cone, and wrestle any woman who wanted to wrestle him.
Well, we also have to get to wrestling at some point this hour, but I do want to welcome callers' questions and comments at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Our guest this hour, Bob Zamuda, and let's take a call on line number 4, caller from Normal. Good afternoon.
Hi. Could you describe how Andy's meditation affected his outlook on life?
Yeah, very much so. As a matter of fact, remember I told you that Andy, when he was a kid performer, he would not have adults in the room. He was only able to perform in front of adults after he learned transcendental meditation. It just freed him up from people looking at him and judging him. And he was he was a governor in the TM movement. He was originally in the 60s, the TM movement was huge. And he was one of the 40 governors of the TM movement. He was a big honcho in the TM movement. And he made sure, in all his contracts for Taxi, any film that he did, any concert appearance, that he had to meditate right before he went on stage. I mean, he backed it in right before. If he was doing Saturday Night Live, he knew that he was going to go on at a certain time, and he would be, and people would get nervous at Saturday Night Live, and I'd stand in front of the door that nobody went into his dressing room, and he would come straight out of meditation, you know, right on stage. And because of that, it was like he was in his own little bubble where nothing could hurt him or harm him. So he believed very much in TM. Eventually, towards the end of his career, of course, the TM movement kicked him out, more or less. And that really broke his heart, because when he started wrestling the women and all that, there was a lot of backlash and from women. And there were some powerful women who were in the TM movement up on top. And when they started seeing the stuff on TV, they thought that was not a good image for somebody in transcendental limitation. So they did not allow him to come to any of the seminars anymore. And it just broke his heart. It was like a devout Roman Catholic being excommunicated from the Catholic Church.
Let's take another call. Line number one, caller from Champaign. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. When he was in Memphis wrestling against like guys like Jerry the King Lawler.
Yes, Jerry the King Lawler.
What time frame? How long did that last? I mean, was it just a couple of months, or how long did that act go on?
Well, I mean, the big thing. I mean, he first went there and started getting into that, and they tried different things, but then eventually the biggie was finally when a promoter called him up from Memphis and said, Andy, we'd like you to wrestle, to be the main ticket, and you to wrestle Jerry the King Lawler in Memphis. And so that was one big match. And both, let me tell you, that match did not last long. That's the one where Jerry the King Lawler gave him the, almost broke his neck.
Mm-hmm.
And we went in and we made a series. It was, you know, and the promoter would call him, Andy, up and say, Andy, ticket sales aren't going well. Can you make some videos that we could run on the wrestling show to get people upset? So that's when we made the series of ridiculous videos.
Oh, they were great.
Andy Kaufman saying, you know, I'm from Hollywood. I'm Andy Kaufman. I got the brains. I'm a big star. I'm going to come down to your neck of the woods. Is that how you say it? Neck of the woods. And you're probably all going to want my autograph because I am a big star. And I'm happy to give you my autograph. But I hear there's a cleansing, there's a clean problem in the South. You folks have a problem with that. So therefore, this is called soap. And he'd show bar soap.
Okay.
Please wash your hands before you come and get my autograph. Well, of course, this drove everybody crazy. So by the time we went down there, a SWAT team had to bring us into the Coliseum.
Wow. At any time between him and Jerry Lawler, did it get out of hand where it wasn't scripted?
Well, of course, you saw what happened on the David Letterman show.
Yeah, uh-huh.
When he slapped him and knocked him off the couch there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what Andy did a lot is, a lot of what Andy did was totally, in many cases, very unscripted and very improvised.
Okay, now he had to be in pretty good shape to take some of those hits, though, and those falls, didn't
Well,
he?
Andy was, you know, Andy, when he was a little kid, and this explains a lot about where Andy's head was, his grandma would take him to Madison Square Garden to see the wrestling matches.
Okay.
So to Andy, the real true theater, his first experience of theater, was the wrestling matches at Madison Square Garden. Well, you could imagine, after being in a little comedy club where there's polite laughter and applause, was like boring to him compared to what took place in that square circle where people were so crazy, especially back then. You know, now the wrestling is a little, people know it's a little tongue-in-cheek and it's like a soap opera and people understand that. Back then, people totally believed what happened, that these people were actually trying to kill each other. So he just loved that, and that concept of wrestling and being and the good versus evil, the good guy versus the bad guy, is very much a part of Andy's conceit. Think of Foreign Man or Latka. That's the sweet guy. That's the good guy. Then there's Tony Clifton, the bad guy. So this had a lot to do with the shaping of his design of his act.
Let's take our next call on line number two, also from Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I've just been curious for years about his dismissal from Saturday Night Live and whether or not that was for real.
Yeah, that.
And I'll hang up and listen.
Unfortunately, that was for real. And just so listeners know, they took a vote on Saturday Night Live, that is Andy Kaufman funny? Do you think Andy Kaufman's funny? And if not, should he be removed from the show, yes or no? Now, Andy called me up, and he had worked this out with Dick Ebersol. This Lorne Michaels was not the producer of the show at the time. Lorne had left to do other things, and Dick Ebersol was the producer of the show. So Andy called me up and said, look, I talked to Dick. We want to do this concept where they vote me. They vote me, and I said, well, Andy, you know they're going to vote you off the show because it's a comedy show, and that's going to be the idea. That will be the fun for the audience to vote him off. I said, why would you want to do this? And he said, well, Bob, they vote me off, and I worked it out with Dick Ebersol that then, in a couple weeks, Tony Clifton comes back on the show. I went, oh, okay, that makes sense now. I get it. Well, a strange thing happened. They vote him off Saturday Night Live, and Dick Ebersol will not take his calls and never puts him back on. And according to Stanley Kaufman, Andy's dad, to this day will tell you, that's what killed his son. He was heartbroken by it. He really felt betrayed.
Now, he did move on to do a sitcom, Taxi. And I know that he was not a big fan of the situation comedy. What prompted him to take on that role?
What prompted him to take on that role is two things. First of all, the deal with Taxi was that his alter ego, Tony Clifton, would make four appearances every year. And then the second thing was that he could, that he knew it would give him celebrity. He knew that a weekly show on television would give him celebrity, so therefore he could then, you know, put on concerts such as Carnegie Hall. He could travel the country. He could go on Letterman. He could go on Johnny Carson because they knew he was the guy from Taxi. So it gave him that celebrity, but he was never, but in a way, he never really liked it. It was like pulling teeth to get him to go to rehearsal for Taxi. I don't think he ever watched one episode of Taxi. And it was by the guy, you know, it's not like he was like a creepy guy that was mean and, oh, you know, he's going to mess with the other actors. It wasn't that at all. It's just that he was an artist. And you know, he wasn't comfortable with six guys in a room writing stupid, lame sitcom jokes. And I think these characters, such as Tony Clifton, such as Latka, which was really the foreign man character, were real personalities, real people in Andy. They were childhood friends of his, fantasy friends that he had discovered, and I don't think he ever felt well that he sold Latka out, that he sold foreign men out for bucks to be on a sitcom. These were real entities of him and of his that he felt in that case he sold out. So when Tony Clifton came on the show for rehearsal,
he did not sell out Tony Clifton at all.
No, Tony Clifton was going to bring down Hollywood. Tony Clifton was going to pay the price for all the abuse that Andy felt was of him selling out. And Tony Clifton, of course, was this lounge lizard character that Andy would turn into for a number of days when his dark side needed to play, is all I could say. Andy was a vegetarian. Andy never smoked. Andy never drank. But when he became Tony Clifton, he had all those vices and prostitutes. It was insane. You know, he had in his contract, George Shapiro, his manager, had in his contract the Taxi that Tony Clifton had to have a parking spot next to Andy Kaufman's with his name on it, that Tony Clifton had to have his own dressing room. It was very strange stuff. And when he would get a little depressed, he'd call me up and say, Bob, I'm leaving town, but Tony's coming to town. I went, oh, boy, here we go. And Tony was a lot of fun. And, of course, in the film, Jim Carrey does a great job of also playing Tony Clifton. And then later on in his career, later on with Andy, when people begin to realize that Tony Clifton was, in fact, Andy Kaufman, he wanted to do one better on the audience, so then he made me Tony Clifton. And I used to go on Letterman, I used to go on Merv, and people thought that it was Andy Kaufman. Letterman would turn to me during the commercial break and say, Andy, if I didn't know it was you, I swear it was somebody else. We had great fun.
Did you ever consider having Andy Kaufman and Tony Clifton on the same show?
Well, we did. At one point, I believe, at Carnegie Hall, Tony opened the show. And then Andy, towards the end, I think Andy brought Tony on to sing a number with him. And that was the only time we tried it. We realized it was really more fun to keep people guessing.
Yeah. And then, of course, after Andy passed away, you revived the character.
Yeah, the one-year anniversary, Andy died on May 16th, and as you can imagine, I was destroyed because I never had anybody close to me die before, let alone my best friend, a health nut, at 35 years old. And it was quite traumatic for me, and the one-year anniversary of his death was coming up, and a little voice in me said, Smuda, quit crying in your soup and put on a tribute to him. So I did. I made three phone calls. I called Mitzi Short, the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, and asked her if I could use the room on a Wednesday night. I then called Robin Williams, who was a friend of Andy's and a friend of mine. I asked him if he'd lend his name to the event. And then I called the American Cancer Society because Andy had died of lung cancer. And I said, look, I've never put on a benefit before in my life. but I want to do this, you know, for my friend, and I give you guys the money. And that became, and I called it Tony Clifton Live. Well, all of Hollywood showed up thinking that this was going to be Andy, that Andy had pulled one of his pranks, and I knew that was going to happen. And that night, that became the catalyst, because I had like 15 comedians on that night, and the whole joke was, well, Tony's not here yet, so here's another act, you know.
Yeah.
And I had like 15 comedians go on that night, and that became the catalyst for me creating Comic Relief. So out of this terrible, terrible, tragic situation of my best friend dying, that show, Tony Clifton Live, became the first Comic Relief. And now, of course, you know, with Robin Williams, Whoopi Goldberg, and Billy Crystal, we've done 8 Comic Reliefs so far. We're going to be doing the 9th one in the spring, and we've raised over $50 million providing much-needed health care for homeless families.
I've been meaning to ask ever since I picked up the book, and maybe before that, to tell you the truth. Based on all the routines that you developed with Andy, how do I know you didn't make up everything that's written in here?
In the book?
Yeah.
Well, look, you don't really know, but the fact of the matter is I think what I wanted to do is, and I think if you read the book, I give all the secrets away of what really went down, because I think there's a greater appreciation for Andy Kaufman if you know what he did. I think there's a greater appreciation. Working for Andy was like working for Harry Houdini, you know?
You see, I'm not even convinced that you're actually Bob Zmuda. You may be Andy Kaufman, and you've assumed Bob's identity all these years.
So. Never know for sure.
That's
right. Maybe I'm Mr. X.
And one last question, and we're running out of time here, but I actually skipped past the dedication in your book and then noticed it this morning.
Uh-huh.
And it says on there, after a short statement, it says in parentheses, Kaufman, if you're still alive, I'll kill you. Can you see him alive somewhere laughing at all of us right now?
Well, here's why I did that, and here's the controversy about that, is Andy Kaufman, did Andy Kaufman fake his death? Andy Kaufman was known as these great, you know, these great hoaxes, these great practical jokes, and he had said to me about a year and a half before he passed away that we're reading reviews, and he said, here's a guy, he said, well, listen to this review, Bob. He says, here's a guy who thinks that I've gone too far and I should just kill myself on stage. He says, hey, this guy's got a good idea. I said, oh, you're going to kill yourself on stage now? He said, no. He said, but what if I faked my death? And right there I said, Andy, this is one thing I can't be a part of. He said, why is that? I said, Andy, it's illegal to fake your death. And that seemed very surprised by him. He said, well, what do you mean? I said, people fake their death every day for child support they don't want to pay. The mafia is looking for them. They want to, you know, embezzle some money from the insurance company. He went, oh, I see. I said, yeah, if you ever did this one, you could not bring me or anybody in on it. You'd have to do it on your own. And then he never brought it up to me again. Now, in writing the book, I interviewed many people, and one of them was John Moffat, who was the executive producer of a TV show called Fridays, which is kind of a ripoff of Saturday Night Live on ABC, a live show. And John Moffat, to this day, thinks Andy Kaufman is alive, because after this, he met with John Moffat. He closed the door in a room, and he had John Moffat swear on a Bible not to tell anybody this, but that Andy was thinking of pulling off the most incredible hoax that would ever be done, which would be faking his death. Now, Lynn Margulies, Andy's girlfriend, who Courtney Love plays in the film, you know, will tell you that, yes, she would always have these discussions with Andy about this, and that what would be the right time that he, if he pulled this off, would he have to disappear for? And they came up with 10 years. He thought 10 years would be right. Well, listen, it's been 15 years now. But I believe, and I want to go on record to say right now, I believe Andy Kaufman is dead. And that, well, another strange thing, you know, him and I wrote a script called The Tony Clifton Story for Universal Pictures, and it was never made. But on page 114 in that script, Andy Kaufman, and this is really weird. That's why there's still executives at Universal Studios who believe Andy is alive. In that script, on page 114, he has Tony Clifton die of lung cancer at Cedars-Sinai Hospital.
Wow.
And years later, Andy Kaufman himself, 8 years later, Andy Kaufman himself would die of lung cancer at that same hospital. So it's because of that is what fuels a lot of this. It's weird, but then Andy was strange.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. really enjoyed talking with you, Bob.
Great, man.
If you're listening from Chicago, Bob will be at Barbara's Books at 1350 North Wells for a signing tonight from 7:30 to 9 p.m. My thanks to my guest, Bob Zamuda, author of Andy Kaufman Revealed and co-executive producer of the upcoming film, Man on the Moon.